talked before about the morning after pill called emergency contraception. We're going to spend some time here in the first few minutes of Issues, Etc., talking about it again. There's been news. The American Medical Association yesterday endorsed the increased use and accessibility to the morning after pill. They're asking the FDA to rethink a temporary ban they put on selling the morning after pill over the counter. They're saying, look, it's safe. There's no question that it's safe. The FDA itself says it's safe. Let's get the thing over the counter. And they've pledged to issue more prescriptions for the morning after pill in order to increase its visibility. We'll be talking about that and President Bush's refusal very recently to ease restrictions on embryonic stem cell research that he put in place in August of 2001 with Dr. David Stevens, Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. That's the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. In the second 25 minutes, or taking that up, John Leo joins us for a few minutes to talk about the loss of the art of argument, and we'll talk about pro-choice Catholic politicians with John Leo of U.S. News and World Report. We'll round off the first hour talking with Diana Sudrith about her life as a Christian in Utah, both as a child and raising her own family as Christians in Utah. The second hour of the program is open lines for your questions and your comments. Yesterday, during a long session of open lines, we talked about the funeral service of Ronald Reagan that was held at the National Cathedral on Friday. We still need to talk about the interment service back in Simi Valley later that evening. We'll hear from audio from that. We'll get your reaction to it. Of course, we can always continue to talk about the funeral or anything else you'd like to talk about during Issues, Etc., open lines in the second hour of the program. Suzanne Venker joins us for the third hour of the program. We're rounding off our series on working mothers, dealing with the last myth on working mothers. I've got a plan. I've got everything planned out. There's the myth. We'll get her response, and we'll spend a better portion of that hour talking with her with your questions and your comments. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our first guest, Dr. David Stevens, is Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Stevens, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Great to be with you, Todd.
Let's talk about the first issue. What set the context for us. To this point, what had the Food and Drug Administration decided about the so-called morning after pill, this emergency contraception?
Though doctors can prescribe this pill, the FDA director came out with a ruling stating that they were not going to legalize it for over-the-counter distribution. They weren't going to put it next to the toothpaste and the vitamins in your pharmacy where anyone could pick it up just like any other medicine. I think that was a good ruling, but the American Medical Association has come out in opposition to that. I'm not too surprised, Todd. AMA is much more of a political organization than it is a scientific one, and I think the science is pretty clear on this issue.
The AMA is claiming, as part of its endorsement to increase access to the morning after pill, that the FDA has already looked this thing up and down and deemed it safe for over-the-counter use, which, of course, would include sale to, what we have to say, minor children, people under the age of 18. Tell us about that. Is it as safe as the AMA is claiming?
Yeah, I don't think it really is. I don't think the studies that they're claiming supports their position really do. We know that the studies have been very limited. Only about 600 women have been studied. And when you look at that, only 29 of them were under the age of 18. How can we set a broad-based policy on those small numbers? They're also concerned is you're giving high-dose hormones to women without any counseling or medical examination. And there are complications to birth control hormones. We know that. If a woman took those pills and got on a flight, had a long flight or something like that, the risk for having an embolus or thrombophlebitis in their legs, blood clots, would be much higher. Women need to know this and know that there are risks involved, and that requires a visit to a physician, not picking these up off the counter right after you get the bread and milk. The other concern is there's no studies to show what repetitive use of these do. Even though the literature shows that you shouldn't use this as your only form of birth control, studies in other countries where this has been legalized have shown that many women, as many as a third, use this as their routine form of contraception. And when they do that, the risk markedly increase. One of my great concerns, Todd, in younger women is that the only time they're going to go see a doctor is to get birth control pills. And that's when you do other health screening for sexually transmitted diseases. That's when you give them counseling concerning their what they're doing, whether they're promiscuous or not, the risk involved in that. And with this being available over the country, over the counter, there is no reason for them to go to the doctor. So you lose that visit and that opportunity to find problems that often promiscuous young women have.
Now, tell us how the morning after pill works and make the case that seems to be somewhat absent in the press. Although I did find it in the Associated Press story, it says it terminates a pregnancy if taken within 72 hours. I think that's probably one of the first times I've read it put in those terms, terminates a pregnancy within 72 hours. What is this drug? What does it do?
It acts actually in two ways. You take it within 72 hours of sexual intercourse, and about 80 to 90% of the time it prevents pregnancy. It does that by if the woman has not ovulated yet, if the egg has not come out of the ovary, it prevents ovulation from taking place. That is contraception. That's preventing the egg from being expelled where a pregnancy can take place. But it also works by creating a hostile environment in the uterus so that the embryo that has already been created through fertilization cannot implant. That is an abortion. Though it says on the packaging, this pill does not cause an abortion. The way they can say that is because the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology has changed the definition of pregnancy to say it doesn't occur till implantation, till the embryo is actually implanted inside the womb. And most of us would say, no, you cause an abortion if the embryo, if fertilization has taken place, there is a new human being and you prevent it from continuing, then you've aborted that baby. And unfortunately, this is an informed consent issue. Women do not get in the packaging the information they need to make an informed consent to know that they could be causing an abortion and taking this medicine.
I'd like to look at that new definition of pregnancy. From a medical standpoint, does that new definition, pregnancy, it does not occur until implantation of a fertilized ovum, does that make sense medically? And does that square with how medicine has traditionally understood pregnancy?
That definition was changed in the mid-90s and as a way to promote some of these new forms of contraception. It was a political move, not a scientific move. If you go to the embryology text, the standard text that you take in medical school, they very clearly say that at the point of fertilization, there is a new developing human being that will continue its development as long as it's left in the proper environment. And therefore, if you interrupt that process, you destroy a human being. And I think most people across this country would agree and would want to know that they are taking a medicine which can actually cause the destruction of a developing human being.
Two more questions on that subject, Dr. Stevens. Dr. Ronald Davis, who headed the AMA committee looking into the matter of emergency contraception and the morning after pill, said that physicians would be writing prescriptions for this drug to make it more readily available and to encourage ways to quickly respond to women who want it. What is the AMA saying they're going to do, apparently regardless of whether or not the FDA approves an over-the-counter use for the morning after pill?
Well, I think that's a political statement much more than a scientific one. What he's saying is we feel so strongly about this, we're going to give these prescriptions out like we hand out flyers at the mall. I think that's irresponsible for any doctor to say that, especially if they have not screened the women involved they're going to be taking this medicine. It was a sad statement, and I was a little upset to see it because I think it ultimately harms the profession of medicine when a doctor speaks in that way.
If they actually were to do this, start aggressively writing prescriptions, recommending this, does that fall within the practice of sound medicine, saying, look, I've got a certain political view about this issue, I'm going to practice my medicine in such a way as to further my political view on this issue?
Well, it's not sound medicine. It's politicizing. There are ideologues, those who are out in front promoting this. They're not looking at the science. They see this as a woman's right issue or a choice issue, and that no one should tell anyone that they can't take this medicine or another medicine. Interestingly enough, all the claims they make that this is going to reduce abortion and that type of thing have actually been disproven in other countries. In the United Kingdom, where this has been available in England, Scotland, Ireland, over the counter for some period of time, it has not reduced the abortion rate, and actually the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases has increased since they made this available. There's a lot of implications when you change a policy like this, and I think that the FDA was well-founded in saying we do not have enough studies to legalize this as a drug across the counter.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our guest, Dr. David Stevens, is Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Their website, by the way, if you'd like to visit it, cmdahome.org, cmdahome.org. Dr. Stevens, the second issue for our conversation has to do with a presidential executive order that was issued in August 2001 by President George W. Bush regarding stem cell lines. Tell us what that order was, and what is the most recent development from the White House this week on entreaties to reverse or to amend that order?
Well, essentially, President Bush put out an order, which was a compromise, but I think the wisest thing to do in that situation. He said federal funds could only be used for research on embryonic stem cell lines that existed after, as of the date he made that decision, which was back, I think, in 2001. And therefore, no funding would be available that would anyway encourage researchers to destroy more embryos. And at that time, there were 50 or 60 embryonic stem cell lines in existence. Proponents are very much wanting to get the federal government to fund embryonic stem cell research and are asking for a relaxing of that policy or reversal of it so that federal funding could go towards developing new embryonic stem cell lines and other research. President Bush rightly has resisted this, even though many congressmen and senators have signed petitions asking him to do that. And I think not only on the moral basis, which is you're destroying a human being when you destroy an embryo for research purposes, but also on the basis of science. What we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years is that we're finding good results using adult stem cells taken from either the placenta, cord blood from newborn babies, or the stem cells that are found in all of our bodies. We're already seeing clinical trials in patients with therapies developed with adult stem cells, whereas embryonic stem cells have not lived up to the hype that has been put out that they're going to cure all these diseases. They're still in the laboratory. There is no clinical applications. What we have found in the last 3 or 4 years is that they're very difficult to work with. They're difficult to culture. They're difficult to get a pure culture without any other embryonic stem cells in a line of tissue that you've developed. And the problem with that is if you develop, try to get embryonic stem cells to turn into heart muscle, for example, and you leave just a few embryonic stem cells in that culture, those embryonic stem cells cause a cancer called a teratoma, which can actually kill the patient. So we found lots of problems with embryonic stem cells, lots of successes with adult stem cells. Yet proponents of this are saying we need to put our money in a methodology that really hasn't worked very well. Part of the reason for that, Todd, is because investor money is not going into this arena. They know it's a pretty much a dead end. It's not going to work, or it's going to take too long, and they're putting their money into adult stem cells research.
So that's why the issue here really is federal funding. If the proponents of embryonic stem cell research know that they're not going to be able to get as many private dollars, they are really asking the government to loosen the purse strings here so that they can fund their research. This is about dollars and cents.
It is about dollars and cents. And people say, well, if adult stem cells work so well, why aren't we hearing more about that? The reason is that there's a group in this country that has invested their research time and reputations into the embryonic stem cell research. And secondly, that's the type of research where you can get a patent and make lots of money. adult stem cells, you just take the cells, put them in the damaged tissue, and they automatically take on the characteristics of the damaged tissue and begin to repair it. So you can't patent them. You can't make lots of money on them. Whereas with embryonic stem cells, there's lots of money to be made. Forbes magazine, Tom, wrote an article on this not long ago, and the title of it concerning them trying to do this with a big bond issue in California over 10 years, $300 million is that, $300 million a year over 10 years, $3 billion, is that they were picking the public's pocket. They knew they couldn't get the money from investors, so they were trying to get the money out of the public pockets. And Forbes magazine came out very much opposed to this.
White House spokesman Scott McClellan said on behalf of the White House, quote, "The president came up with a policy that will allow us to explore the promise of stem cell research and do so in a way that doesn't cross a certain moral threshold that he set." For the sake of clarity, make it clear to us all, what was that moral threshold that the president set back in August 2001?
He did not want to create an incentive for scientists or to reward scientists who destroyed more embryos. And, ideally, he would not have put any federal funding into embryonic stem cell research, but he compromised to the point of saying, we will let you have funds for embryonic stem cell lines that already exist. The reason he did that is because if he hadn't have, he would have been overruled in Congress and we would have had federal funding for all embryonic stem cell research. It was the best he could get at that point, and he drew a very clear line, which has stood up for 3 or 4 years. If we're going to see so much success in this embryonic stem cell arena, why haven't we seen it already? It's not been a lack of money, because a lot of investors threw money at it and found out there was no results. They've stepped back, and now the researchers are going after public funds.
So since this is based entirely upon an executive order from this president, if George W. Bush were to lose in the presidential election and not be there in the White House to uphold his executive order, how likely would this order continue? How likely would it be that federal funds for embryonic stem cell research would be thus limited?
I think it would be about a one-day limit before it changed. I think what's been expressed from the other side of this election is that they would support this in a minute. You know, one of the things, Todd, that really upsets me about this, though, is how people have come out and used Ronald Reagan's death to support the idea of embryonic stem cell research, when Ronald Reagan very clearly said that he did not want to diminish the value of one category of human life, the unborn, and that he valued human life from the moment of fertilization, that we should protect it. And crassly, people who have proposed this are using his disease, Alzheimer's disease, and saying through Nancy Reagan and through the press that, wow, we could have saved his life if we had just supported embryonic stem cell research. That is ridiculous. And even today, I read an article in Science magazine saying that scientists are saying that the chances of curing Alzheimer's with embryonic stem cell research is almost nil.
When people hear stories about Ronald Reagan's last years with Alzheimer's, or they watch Christopher Reeves, a paraplegic, or Michael J. Fox, a victim of Parkinson's disease at a rather young age, when they see all of this on TV, and they're calling for embryonic stem cell research, and they're talking about the promise, how would you make the case to disagree with them? And it's very compelling when the people themselves with the diseases are calling for embryonic stem cell research.
I think the thing that upsets me the most is the way snake oil salesmen, for want of a better word, scientists are standing up and claiming that if we do this, they're going to cure all these diseases, when the science doesn't support it and the chances of this happening are remote at best. I think they are preying on people in the time of their desperate need. And that saddens me. It cheapens science in this country and politicizes this issue, with people coming up and giving heart-wrenching stories or heart-wrenching images of their problems, and then people saying, if you just give this money, we'll cure them. I can't think of anything that's worse to do to a patient that's struggling to live every day than to do that.
One of the things that I found, we have about a minute here to answer Dr. Stevens, that I found rather interesting, and you could kind of see it coming when the president said, here's 60 or 70 or 80 stem cell lines where we don't have to cross the moral threshold. And it seemed as though people said, well, okay, that's not what we wanted, but fine enough, we won't need any more than that. And that was the basis of the president's compromise. Within months, they were saying, not enough, not enough. It seems as though the stakes were constantly being raised on the number of stem cell lines they thought they would need to keep the promises they were making. Your thoughts?
That's true, and there is a slippery slope. Once you say that the embryo is not a person, this is not a human being, you can do anything you want to it. And we're seeing more and more of this happening on other ethical issues, including cloning. You cannot do embryonic stem cell therapy, even if it did work, without cloning the patient. You have to have tissue that tissue matches them, that won't be rejected. So each of us, if this is successful, will be asked to be cloning ourselves, creating our brother or sister, destroying our brother and sister to take cells to manipulate in the lab to treat our diabetes, heart attack, or stroke. That's going to be a moral quagmire for this country as each of us face that issue. And we should not be heading down this path because we're just going to get into more and more moral issues.
And finally, Dr. Stevens, with only a minute here, some might argue that you're hamstringing, hobbling science, putting science in a box by saying you cannot go into this area of research. How do you respond to that?
Science needs to have moral boundaries, and especially when it comes to the destruction of human life. We have research guidelines already that prohibit us from injuring people when we do research on them. Why should it be different for unborn human beings than it is for born human beings? One other thing, Todd, if people want more information on this, they can check out our website. You mentioned it, cmdahome.org. Look for Standards for Life. Those are easy informations written in layman's terms on abortion, stem cell research, and cloning. People can upload them on their church website, or they can use a PDF file to teach a Sunday school class or talk at a Rotary Club. We need to educate people on this issue.
Dr. David Stevens is Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Stevens, I thank you for your time, and please keep up the good work.
Thank you, Todd.
Folks, you can check out the website for the Christian Medical and Dental Association, cmdahome.org. And as Dr. Stevens recommended, look for Standards for Life there at the website. A good resource, cmdahome.org. When we come back from this break, a conversation with John Leo of U.S. News and World Report magazine. You've seen his On Society column. He's a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. We're going to be talking to him about two issues. First, pro-choice Catholic politicians. Why is it that Catholics, when polled lately, to the tune of about 23%, say, yeah, we'd be willing to vote for a Roman Catholic politician that deviates from the Church's teaching on life, but the vast majority of them, the balance of that 100%, say, no, this is an issue that matters to us. And yet, Roman Catholic politicians, some of them prominent, some of them less prominent, feel rather free to fly afoul of their church's teaching on life. Will it be a presidential issue? The other thing we're going to talk about with John Leo when we come back, the loss of the art of argument. Why is it that we dismiss rather than discuss, that we simply walk out of the room when we disagree rather than stand and argue? John Leo is next. Stay tuned.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Let's face it, most Christians just don't know what to do with the Old Testament book of Leviticus. Does it still apply today? If so, how? How are we to rightly understand the Old Testament law, ceremonial, civil, and moral? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. For more information on this book, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. Or order it by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus.
You have the talent to serve Christ globally. This Global Minute lets you hear that it starts with loving children, or fixing cars, or delivering babies, and more. In garbage dumps around Manila, in the Philippines, or in Mexico City, there are loving men and women who hold Bible studies with children who rummage through the trash. They serve with Action International Ministries, which got started to show Christ's love to boys and girls who lived on sidewalks or under bridges. There's also a job training component to Action's programs, where Christians who have mechanical talent can help former street children learn employable skills. Action International's missionaries also offer resources and assistance to pastors to help them meet the needs of families in poverty and disciple them to follow Christ. Pray for more Christians to use their talents in spiritually needy parts of the globe. Learn more by visiting the website www.actionintl.org. That's actionintl.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. How do you feel about performance reviews at work? A 40th anniversary today reminds us that your boss may not have a clue. On June 15, 1964, the St. Louis Cardinals traded Ernie Broglio to the Chicago Cubs for Lou Brock. Broglio wasn't a bad player, but Brock went on to be a Hall of Famer. Obviously, the Cub higher-ups had their performance reviews all wrong, and maybe the Cardinals did too. Maybe they were lucky. I doubt that many of us say God loves me and let it roll off our back when we get a bad review. It can chew us up. That difference between the evaluation and our own self-image. Get bitter or grow better. If you factor in the divine performance review, you are a sinner, but forgiven and forever loved, you'll be moving your feelings forward positively, maybe your career as well. So whether your boss is clueless or clued in and you don't know it, Christ's example, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Christ's forgiveness, he bore our sins. And Christ's word of peace, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world, can help you cope and give you hope. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, Our Thought for the Day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, It's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. John Leo joins us, author of the On Society column for U.S. News and World Report magazine. He joins us from New York to talk about two issues. First of all, pro-choice Catholic politicians, and then we'll also be talking about the loss of the art of debate or argument with John Leo. John, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
John, how are Roman Catholic voters polling in advance of the presidential election here in November, on how they will or intend to vote for pro-choice Catholic lawmakers?
I'm not really up to speed on the latest numbers. In general, there's some impact. Catholics seem to be less likely than others to support abortion candidates or pro-choice candidates, if an issue is made of it. But it's not dramatically different from the rest of the electorate.
One of the things you've written about recently in your column is a Zogby poll in which John Kerry is shown getting low support among the America's 51 million Catholics on issues where he opposes the church's position. Now, how do we account for the way that Roman Catholics at least seem to intend to vote here?
There's no easy answer to that. First of all, you have to judge each poll on its merits. Zogby is something of a maverick in the polling world, and he's the only one that came up with that finding. So I don't know how to weigh that. Polls are very uncertain. They depend on what questions are asked and whether it's likely voters or just people at random. So I guess I have no direct opinion on the Zogby poll. I guess that if it's made an issue, Catholics will respond to it more directly. But they have many other things to worry about besides that.
What about the issue of the Roman Catholic bishops in the American Catholic Church? They seem to, at least some of them, are saying, look, we've got to deal with this issue of Roman Catholic lawmakers who are running afoul of the church's teaching on life. Others don't seem so interested in that subject. Talk about that for a while, please.
Sure. There's about 300 bishops, maybe 100 to 150 run dioceses. In other words, are in charge of huge areas. And of that 300 number, only four have said they definitely would deny communion to John Kerry because of his pro-choice stance. Now, there are probably another 15 or so who are vocally troubled about it and or wish that Kerry would not present himself for communion. So I guess you could say 5% of the bishops are speaking out on this. I think many more are concerned. So it's a trend. It's not a large trend right now, but it's a fascinating issue that could explode between now and November.
This, of course, is not a new subject, but how would you explain what appears to be just the hesitance on the part of some of the bishops to deal with this issue, to speak out publicly? Others have been very vocal, but how would you explain it?
I think part of it goes back to the mess they made out of the priest sex scandals. I think they sat on that for so long, 15 years or so, that they are in a position where they're worried about their credibility now. If they don't, they feel, I think, that if they don't speak out on a core issue for the Catholic Church, they're going to look like terrible wimps who don't even pay attention to their own doctrine. So that's why I think they want to make an issue of it. The Democratic friends tell me they think it's a partisan issue. I don't think it is. I think the bishops are really worried about being taken seriously on what they regard as a key issue.
Is there any official Vatican position on voting, on the average Roman Catholic voting, how lawmakers vote on the life issue?
No, the church doesn't think that way. The church doesn't draw a direct line from doctrine to voting because of the virtue of prudence, which in Catholic terms does not mean wishy-washy virtues. It means practical wisdom, that the church will teach you respect for life, and then it's up to you to decide what you're going to vote for. So there is never a direct line, or should not be, a direct line between doctrine and voting. So what the church is really saying to John Kerry is, this is not like capital punishment or the war in Iraq where there's a lot of wiggle room. There's no wiggle room on abortion. It's unjustified homicide to the Catholic Church, and you must regard it that way. But how you vote is up to you. Mario Cuomo made a big speech on this 20 years ago at Notre Dame in which he said, you can't impose your views on non-Catholics. Well, I agree with that. But what was missing from Governor Cuomo's speech was that the Catholics are supposed to do something. In other words, they don't have to vote for a constitutional amendment or even vote against partial birth abortion. But they do have to do something to try to forge a consensus to keep abortion down and maybe someday end it. So John Kerry, in the eyes of the church, is under an obligation to do something, but not to vote any particular way.
Why do Catholic politicians behave so oddly on the subject of abortion?
Well, I think it's obvious. The Democratic Party does not tolerate dissent on abortion. I mean, there is not a single important Democratic politician anywhere in America who has publicly stated qualms about abortion, let alone opposition to it. There are a few congressmen here or there in very conservative areas, but there's no important Democrat left. And if you want to be on the presidential track, you have to switch opinions on abortion, as Jesse Jackson did, and Gebhardt, and Clinton, and Gore. So a long line of people who had definite opposition to abortion have done what Kerry did and just switched in midstream to further their ambition.
We're talking with John Leo, author of the On Society column for U.S. News and World Report. He joins us from New York. John, finally on that subject, how big of an issue will abortion be in the presidential election?
Well, if I had to make a guess, I don't think it'll be a very big issue. The reason it could explode, though, is that the Democrats have become the secular party and the Republicans have become the religious party, and the polls show a definite split there. The more you go to church, the more you believe in God, the more likely you are to vote Republican. And the exact opposite is true of Democrats. The more secular you are, the more doubts you have about religion, the stronger you are as a Democrat. So that fault line is right there in the electorate. It's one of the big fault lines, much bigger than the gender gap, which gets all the publicity.
John, you've also written about the lost art of argument, and you begin your column by talking about an experience speaking at a small dinner in New York. Tell us your story there.
Well, I went to speak at this little dinner, like 16 people, and I talked about the university system and how troublesome it is now. All the canceled speakers, stolen newspapers, the indoctrination you get at freshman orientation, all these things. It's a very repressive sight what's happened to the universities. And I talked about that, and most of the people at the dinner seemed to agree with me. And a university president of some note here in New York got up and said, "That's the most intellectually dishonest speech I've heard in my life." And he rattled on for a few sentences, and I couldn't figure out what he was getting at. And then he said it again, "The most intellectually dishonest set of remarks I've ever heard." And he stomped out and closed the door behind him. And it set me on this reverie about whatever happened to debate. I think what he meant to say is you're wrong, or you're exaggerating, or something. But he didn't make his case. He just got mad and stomped out. And I thought, gee, that's really what's happened. And I quoted a few people talking about the death of real debate. We have scream shows like Crossfire, and we have paired left-right people on many programs who say extreme things and then get off the air. But we don't have any real debate. And I was making a plea for not the screamers, but for ordinary people or smart people to have a real discussion of issues that doesn't involve name-calling or stomping out.
You mentioned William F. Buckley, Jr., how he would, in earlier days, really offer debate to anyone who would take him on, but it didn't necessarily mean that the two would end as enemies.
Right. Buckley debated anybody. He debated Steve Allen several times, Michael Harrington, the socialist Catholic, and all kinds of people. And it was a very civil thing. He might mildly criticize somebody during the debate, but they would always go out and have a drink afterwards, if not dinner. And that was the model I used in my column, that you don't have to take everything personally. You don't have to hate everybody who disagrees with you, and you don't have to get mad. I do think I got an enormous reaction to this column, much more than I expected. And I think it's about the hunger for civility and debating of ideas rather than trashing everybody and the incredible name-calling, Taliban and so-and-so is Hitler. I mean, this is not the way to carry on, and it's become the dominant form of alleged debate in America.
So how did we lose the art of civil argument? Two people honestly disagreeing, perhaps not even coming to an agreement at the end of their argument, but still respecting and tolerating one another as individuals.
Well, it's an open question on how we got here. I mean, the Democrats will point to the trashing of Clinton, and the Republicans will point back to the trashing of Robert Bork. Whoever started it, it's certainly a very polarized situation, and it's accelerated or aggravated by television, because television likes sharpened confrontation and short sound bites. I even find myself, I go on and I come out of the studio thinking, gee, that was more vehement than I really feel on this subject. And I think television does that. You're under such pressure to produce a soundbite and do it quickly that we get much more polarization, even in style.
Finally then, John, what can we gain if we regain our skills and the art of real argument?
Well, I think we open up the middle for more moderate people. That's one advantage. And the other is that we teach the young that we are not just maddened adults out to crucify our opponents, but that you can have respect for an opponent or an adversary and take his or her argument seriously and sometimes even change your own mind. It's a much more promising political culture than we happen to have right now.
John Leo's On Society column appears in U.S. News and World Report magazine. You can also read his recent columns, The Beauty of Argument and Kerry's Abortion Problem, on usnews.com. That's usnews.com. John joined us from New York. John, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Now, coming up in about 10 minutes, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. The question that I'd like to lay before you today during that second hour of the program has to do, yesterday we talked about the Reagan funeral at the National Cathedral. Today we're going to talk about the Reagan interment. That was the burial service that took place in Simi Valley Friday evening. The sunset service, according to the president's own wishes, he was given a sunset burial befitting a U.S. president. As we listen to the comments, I want you to ask yourself this question. And your reactions, freely given, are obviously welcome as well. Was he given a burial befitting a Christian? Yes, a burial befitting a U.S. president. What about a burial befitting a Christian? We'll be playing some excerpts from that burial service of President Reagan here in the next hour in just a few minutes. Diana Sedgwick is our guest. She joins us. She's a member of Trinity Lutheran Church in St. George, Utah. She was raised in Mormon land, in LDS land. She's author of an article in a new Lutheran women's magazine called The Fount. I'll tell you more about it in just a minute. Diana's article is entitled Keeping the Faith. We're going to talk about being a Christian in Utah, in LDS land. Diana, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Diana, tell us your story. What is it like both to grow up as a Christian surrounded by a majority of Latter-day Saints, but also to return there later in life to raise your own children surrounded by Latter-day Saints as Christians?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, isn't it, that I would do that. Growing up in Utah is kind of difficult. It's really different than probably being in a lot of the rest of the United States. The LDS faith is one that proselytizes very heavily and is a very close society. And so when I was growing up, I knew I wasn't part of that society. And especially my high school years were really, really tough. Didn't get invited on dates, knew that I was, you know, kind of on the outside of what a lot of other people were doing. Finished high school, went to college in Utah mainly for financial reasons with the one goal of just getting out of Utah. And then 10 years later came back to raise my own family here because by that time I realized there were some good things about growing up in an LDS environment. And probably the biggest one is that it really helped me to understand my own faith, to understand the differences between Lutheranism, other Christian faiths, and other non-Christian faiths. And I knew that that kind of strength was something that I wanted for my own children. And so we came back here. My husband and I chose to come to southern Utah, where the weather is a little nicer than it is in northern Utah, and raise our kids.
Now, so you're bringing them back not only because it is an atmosphere in which under this kind of, you use the word persecution several times in your article in The Fount, where under this kind of intense scrutiny as being an outsider, the Christian faith can actually flourish, but also it's a pretty decent place to live in terms of just, raising a family?
Oh, absolutely. Whenever you read articles about where in the United States religion has the strongest hold, Utah is always way high on the list. My neighbors almost all go to church. They raise moral children. Drinking is not allowed in the LDS faith. Smoking is not allowed. So there are a lot of problems that we just really don't have here, like perhaps some of my cousins in the Midwest have talked about the problems with high school drinking. We really don't have that around here. Not to say that it doesn't exist, but it's not to the degree that it is some other places. We can still feel pretty confident leaving doors open and trusting people. I teach high school and love my students. They're respectful, and it's a very easy place to teach. And so there's a lot of really good things like that. But I did talk about persecution in the article because especially when I was growing up, that is how I felt. The LDS church provides a lot of activities for their youth, and I wasn't, if I was invited to those activities, it was to try to get me to join the church. I wasn't invited just for who I was. As I said, I had a steady boyfriend through high school, but I wasn't invited on other dates with other people. And the same thing has really happened to my kids as I've watched them. There are certain activities that they're not invited to, and sometimes they feel like they're on the outside. And it's very difficult when I consider my faith to be a part of who I am, my children do too, I can't completely share who I am with the people that I'm with on a day-to-day basis because they don't understand that part of me. And that's been really hard for my kids because teenagers need to have that kind of connection with other people outside of the family. There comes a time when the family can't really fulfill those needs. It's very difficult for them to find that kind of support outside of the home.
You also write about this Mormon segment of society, if we could speak of it in those terms, that is Utah and other northwestern states, parts of them, as, in your words, sugar-coated and perfect on the outside, but hiding the dreadful disease that lurks in unforgiven souls. What do you mean by that?
Well, the LDS faith is based on being good enough to go to heaven, and there are a lot of requirements. As I said, adults don't drink, they don't smoke, they must tithe 10% of their income as a part of the requirement to get into their highest heaven, and there's a very long list of things that they need to do. So part of the society is sort of pretending that everybody is meeting all of those requirements. They're not really allowed to sin. There's not really forgiveness as we know it. In the Lutheran faith, we're allowed to sin because we know that Jesus will forgive us. They're not allowed to sin. They have to earn their way to heaven. And so they pretend as if they are perfect. And, you know, we all know nobody can be perfect. And so they hide a lot, and it can be quite painful. I have several LDS friends who, you know, live in pain because of the things that they have to hide from their neighbors.
What about being a Christian adult? You talked about being a child there in your childhood, raising children, the experiences that are being relived by your children there in a Mormon context. What about being a Christian adult in a Mormon society? What's that like?
You know, I guess it's really a matter of different people handle that differently. I know there are days that my husband and I come home from work and say, we've got to get out of here. We can't take it anymore. And then there are other days that I think I'm so happy here that I could live here until the day that I die. I think a really important part of our happiness here is with our congregation. We really feel like the people at Trinity are our family, and they're the ones that we turn to when we need help, when we need an ear to talk to. They are our social group. It makes it difficult in our day-to-day dealings where, as I said, I'm a school teacher, and there's only one other Christian school teacher in our high school, and there's probably 50 faculty members. That's kind of tough on a day-to-day basis. But on Sunday, I can go to church and I can be with my Lutheran brothers and sisters, and that gives me the ability to make it through another week.
Does it feel, I mean, from a woman and a wife's perspective, does it feel a bit like Stepford Wives sometimes?
Actually, we've used that phrase. Yeah, it does, very much, very much. I have friends. I have an LDS friend who one day went to they call it Relief Society, which is their women's group, and their presenter that day was telling the women that they could not go to heaven if they were employed outside of the home. That's not even an option for them. She was very upset by that, but had to pretend that it was okay because she was employed outside of the home, and she had to be in order to help support her family. And yet she has to live with two faces. Very difficult.
What about witnessing two Mormons when the Mormon isn't the minority who happens to show up at your doorstep? You know, the two elders show up nicely appointed. God drops them on your doorstep for an opportunity for you to witness to them. But when you are the minority, the minuscule minority.
That's true. Actually, the elders do drop by on my doorstep because they know who's LDS and who's not. So I do have the opportunity to witness to them. We find that there are people that God puts into our life that we are able to witness to. My husband was raised LDS. So obviously I witnessed to him when we started dating, and now he is one of the elders in our church. My sister also married an LDS man who is now a member of our church. My daughter is currently dating an LDS young man who is not making any move towards changing, but my daughter witnesses to him constantly. God puts people in our life, and he opens doors, and he gives us chances to share forgiveness and love, and sometimes that sharing takes root.
I got to ask you before I let you go, as a father of a daughter myself, does it make it, dating is nerve-wracking enough from a parent's perspective when your daughter is dating a Mormon boy? What's that like?
It's nerve-wracking. We are concerned. They're both 18. They graduated this year. Our daughter is going to a Christian university in Colorado, and her boyfriend's not, and we're pretty excited about that. It's pretty tough, really, but you have to just kind of take it through, and like I said, my parents allowed me to date an LDS guy, and look how it turned out. You never know how God will use different people.
Diana Sudreth, thank you very much for writing the article in The Fount, and thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
You're welcome, Todd. It's been a pleasure.
Diana Sudreth is a member of Trinity Lutheran Church in St. George, Utah, surrounded by Mormons. She's author of an article in a new Lutheran women's magazine called The Fount. Her article is titled Keeping the Faith. Now, when we come back, I'll give you the mailing address for this new Lutheran women's magazine called The Fount, and it's open lines for your questions and your comments, an entire hour of open lines. Anything you'd like to talk about, as usual, I would love to get your reaction to both the funeral and the interment service, the burial service for Ronald Reagan that was held on Friday. Yesterday we talked about the funeral. We played a bit of Jack Danforth's, what do you call it, a homily? Barely qualified as a Christian sermon. If that, we'll hear audio when we come back during open lines from the interment service. Back in Simi Valley, President Reagan is being laid to rest by his pastor, Bel Air Presbyterian Church Pastor Venning. We've heard much of him in the last week. We'll see what he had to say. Of course, the president was laid to rest at sunset in California, beautiful setting, surrounded by family in the eulogy of his children, in a manner befitting a U.S. president. Was he laid to rest in a manner befitting a Christian? When we come back, open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then, in the third hour of the program, Suzanne Venker joins us, author of the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. We'll round off our series on working mothers, dealing with the final myth, that is, I've got it all planned out, don't you see? I can work, I can have it all, because I have a plan, and we'll take your questions and your comments, instead of just a half hour with Suzanne, an entire hour, because we always get your questions and comments at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. That's the third hour of Issues, Etc. Tomorrow on the program, the Bush presidency with Bill Salmon, senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times. He has written this book called Misunderestimated. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. We'll also be talking about the rise of evangelicalism with Dr. Mark Knoll of Wheaton College. Open Lines is next. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.